to get back to work the next day. I was excited to talk with those at home about the race. After checking into the airport, I dug my phone out, listened to voicemails, and checked emails. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe how many people had seen the footage of me and Lance running together. After the elite men and women were done with the race, the main story was Lance, so the camera was locked on him and me by default. The most welcome of all the voicemails came from Tracy. My wife's voice was thick with emotion as she spoke. "Cam, I'm watching you on TV right now and I can't believe it. You are running stride for stride with Lance, and I just want to tell you how good you look, how strong you are running, and how proud I am of you. I have tears welling up in my eyes watching you, because I know how hard you have worked to do what you are doing right now. Call me." It's still the sweetest, most heartfelt message I've ever received. I stood there in the bustle of the airport, absorbing every single word she said, shaking my head thinking what a lucky man I am. Later on, Tracy told me that Truett, our youngest son, just sat on the couch and watched me on television with a big smile on his beaming face, not saying a word. I learned later that Tanner and Truett's school gave an announcement over the intercom saying their dad ran with Lance Armstrong in the Boston Marathon and beat him. Truly an incredible day. That happened in 2008, back when Lance was a sports god, back when the world revered him, including me. Before the doping scandal and the public outrage and everything that followed. Did any of that diminish my thoughts on running the marathon with him? Absolutely not. Here's the deal. It's over. Lance paid the price for his misdeeds. He was stripped of his wins, forfeited millions of dollars, and lost more in respect. Running with him for an entire second half of that race was surreal. It was also an honor. All the stuff that has come out about him since then doesn't tarnish my memory of running with Lance. That was also around the same time I started getting hated on for putting too much emphasis on training with regard to mountain hunting. That criticism lives on, but just like back then, it doesn't have any impact on the amount of drive I have to best prepare my body and mind for the test that is bow hunting. Not long ago, I watched the ESPN documentary Lance and loved it. I know everyone probably has a different take on Lance, but for me, he was a legend and is still a transcendent icon despite his rocky past. It probably has a lot to do with my age and where the legend of Lance, who at one time was considered the greatest endurance athlete of all time, fit in my life. I saw in that documentary that Lance still has the same fire burning inside of him. I remain a fan. Visualize success. Over the years, I've talked about that with respect to bow hunting. Expecting success, working tirelessly to perform in crunch time, giving nothing less than your very best. These are the ways bow hunters achieve their dreams. Anything is possible. Dreams can become reality to the goal-oriented hunter. This fact is proven time and time again in the rugged mountains of the West each and every fall. In the Boston Marathon, I put the visualization theory to the test. Runners and hunters share common threads. To be successful in each discipline requires many of the same attributes: commitment, dedication, and above all, damn hard work. Endurance events like marathons or ultramarathons ratchet this commitment up another level, much like backcountry bow hunting. To run a 10K, you can prepare by running a few miles a day, 3 days a week. It's really not that tough. To run a marathon, you should be running 5 or 6 days a week, 7 to 10 miles a day on average, with long runs occasionally over 20 miles. There's nothing easy about that, and that's the draw. Easy seldom makes memories. Similarly, backcountry bow hunting is not something you do successfully on a whim. Many have tried and many have failed. But to those who have ramped up what they expect of themselves in the mountains, geared their training to maximize every ounce of their ability, and ultimately find success, well, it is a powerful experience to say the least. To some, life-changing. All I have to do is look in the mirror to see an example of what I'm referring to. For many years, a 10K was the farthest I'd ever run. Then I consciously made my off-season training match my hunting in terms of intensity. I expect a lot of myself in the backcountry, and I figured the best way to prepare for the difficult challenge of mountain bow hunting would be to put myself through hell training during the spring and summer. Cry in training, laugh and battle. That pretty much summed up my newly defined approach to excel in bow hunting back in those days. One reason I respect Lance Armstrong is that if anybody gets this statement, it's him. I love some of the things he has said about training and determination. I'm not happy if I'm not doing some physical suffering, like going out on a bike ride or running, Lance told Time magazine. First, it's good for you. Number two, it sort of clears my mind on a daily basis, and it's a job. My job is to suffer. I make the suffering and training so hard that the races are not full of suffering. Not only did Lance train hard, but he was also one of the fiercest competitors ever. After winning his fifth Tour de France in 2003, he defiantly said, "No one trains like me. No one rides like me. This jersey is mine. I live for this jersey. It's my life. No one is taking it from me. This fucking jersey's mine." Lance didn't just visualize success. He also visualized crushing his competitors. I respect that mindset. There was someone else who celebrated my run in Boston that day. My dad. Since I'd always felt like we had a connection that came through track and running, racing in the Boston Marathon next to Lance Armstrong was a thrill for him. My dad knew what it took to sacrifice and try to be the best. He loved seeing me on TV running with the legend. Up till then, he had never really given me credit for my hunting. As I mentioned earlier, he liked to tell me that every time I killed an animal, I lost brain cells. Instead of getting credit, I usually got dismissed for my outdoor adventures. Running was different. Now he finally had something about me that he could brag about with others. "You know, my son beat Lance Armstrong." To my dad, this was a lot more exciting than talking about the biggest buck I ever killed. Everybody knew Lance. Just to be in an endurance event with him was kind of cool. As I've said, the only hero I had growing up was my dad. Now that I had officially beaten America's hero, mine was beyond proud. When the Oregonian newspaper ran an article about me and Lance in the marathon, I love where it acknowledged me simply as Bowhunter. "Bowhunter beats Armstrong," the headline read. That is exactly how I like it. I'm simply a Bowhunter, nothing more, nothing less, and I'll be a Bowhunter until the day I die. What does running the Boston Marathon have to do with Bowhunting? Everything. Oh, I can hear the chorus of guys who offer up the same old tired statement time and time again. You don't need to be able to run a marathon to kill with a bow. I agree. You don't need to do a lot of things to kill animals with a bow. But one thing I do know, the better shape you're in, the better your chances are for staying 100% committed, mentally and physically, to your bow hunting goals. I've obsessed about mountain bow hunting so much for so long, I feel like the comparisons and similarities I've concocted are valid and worth sharing. In my opinion, mountain bow hunting is not that much different from other performance sports like basketball, football, and running in regard to evolution. I think the ultimate performance endeavor, bare-knuckle bow hunting, is evolving and progressing in much the same way as those other sports. A few decades back, professional football players wore leather helmets, and I remember seeing an old NFL locker room photo in which the players looked like they could have been talking politics or, at 6 feet, 175 pounds, they could have been insurance salesmen talking about the benefits of higher deductibles. Compare that with the images of NFL players today, they're beasts. Solid muscle, and track star fast. They rewrite the record books with ever-increasing skills and definitely no leather helmets. Basketball, same deal. Have you ever seen old footage of Bob Cousy dribbling a basketball and shooting? I have, and I don't remember ever seeing him touch a ball with his left hand. No disrespect intended, because during his day, he was the man. But a shot reminded me of my wife's when she's out shooting hoops with our boys. Yes, the game has evolved, big time. Running, same deal. Pretty much every single running record is broken every few years. And in my favorite sport, ultramarathon running, men and women are running faster and farther every year. Similarly, in bow hunting, yesterday's legends might struggle to keep up with today's hunter athletes. And shooting, there's some archery snipers out there these days. Let me clarify one thing. Backcountry bow hunters are athletes, but they will face challenges other athletes will not. For most sports, the training and goals are pretty straightforward. Sprinters train to increase speed. Weightlifters train to get stronger. The goals are easily defined, the results easily measured and tracked, and cheering crowds justify the effort. At some point in every long run, I want to quit, and the same holds true on tough bow hunts. Many times, I've wanted to cry, no mas. By no means am I a great hunter or a world-class archer. What sets me apart is my ability to suffer. I love every minute of bow hunting, but I've yet to be on an easy backcountry bow hunt, so I train like a professional athlete. I train to bleed. Some people like to take what I say and turn it into, Cam says everybody needs to be able to run a marathon or they won't kill an elk. I've never said anything close to that. Listen, I don't care what you do. For me, this is how I feel and what works for me. Does that mean everybody should do what I do? No way. Do whatever you want to do, whatever gives you confidence, whatever makes you feel good, whatever makes you feel empowered. Do that. If that's shooting your bow, do that. If that's playing chess, go for it. Do something that inspires you and makes you work hard. I'm inspired by people who give their best every day. Those people believe what I believe. Anything, and I mean anything, is possible. Theodore Roosevelt said, "We admire the man who embodies victorious effort, the man who never wrongs his neighbor, who is prompt to help a friend, but who has those virile qualities necessary to win in the stern strife of actual life." Where are the places in your life where you can achieve a victory? It doesn't have to be the Boston Marathon. It can be building a bridge to a relationship or beginning a journey to recovery. Addicts and alcoholics record their sobriety not for sound bites, but rather as triumphs. What can you do with your passion to achieve important benchmarks of success? Thank you, critics. From the bottom of my heart, thank you. Thank you for your unsolicited advice on how I train. I appreciate your comments on my rest and recovery. It's nice to know your suggestions about how much I should sleep. I love learning about how I should lift. It's nice to know where you stand on politics and where I shouldn't stand. Remind me a few more times why I shouldn't be running. And yes, my deepest and most sincere gratitude for your critique of my music. May I respectfully just add one little thought? Unless you can help me put a broadhead lead arrow through the vitals of a big bull, bear, buck, or buffalo, your opinion doesn't mean much to me. And by, quote, much, I mean absolutely nothing. Bow hunting is my purpose and the only thing I've ever been good at. I'm not a runner, so criticize my running all you want. I'm not a weightlifter, so critique my lifting and strength as it means nothing to me. Hell, you don't hunt? Go ahead and judge me for hunting and killing animals to feed myself. If you're a fellow hunter, bash me to make yourself look better. I'm good with it, because in the mountains come September, if my arrow lands true, I'll be bent over a fallen bull elk putting my knife to work, and all your opinions of me won't make you any happier or make me feel any less fulfilled in my journey as a bow hunter and provider. If you're a fellow honorable diehard and live to roam bow in hand, you have my respect. Or if you're a new-to-the-fray archer, welcome to the brotherhood. Bow hunting can change your trajectory and give you a new perspective on life. If you're a critic and a couch life coach, please keep your comments and criticism coming. I love being entertained and appreciate the fuel. See you at the top. Chapter 9. Train hard, hunt easy. The gods of the valley are not the gods of the hills, and you shall understand it. Ethan Allen. Cam, can't you just do the 50-miler? I was on the cusp of my first ever 100-mile mountain run in 2009 when Tracy said this. I still couldn't believe I was only days away from the Bighorn 100, taking place in the rugged Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming. With over 17,000 feet of elevation gain, the Bighorn 100 was one of the toughest 100-mile foot races in the United States. It'd be my first ultra over 50 miles. The previous year at the Bighorn 50, I finished third overall. It would also be the first race where I'd be required to run through the night. A full day of running, followed by a full night of mountain running, sounded intimidating among other things. My wife was having second thoughts and tried to persuade me to reconsider. "You could do really well in a 50-miler," she said. "You won't have to run at night, but that race will still drive your message home. And I've read people have kidney failure sometimes on those crazy long runs." She made some good points, and she almost had me a couple times, but I remained determined. "I've already done a 50-miler," I said. My goal is to find out exactly what I can do, to find where's my breaking point. Not long after this conversation, my dad called me at night with the same sort of concern. "Cam, you don't have anything left to prove. No one cares if you do a 100-miler. "Ah, but Dad, you are wrong. I know full well not many will ever do a 100-miler or even have it as a goal, but many guys could be influenced by the standard it sets. Guys who are on the regular run and feeling fatigued might think about my race and the challenges associated and find themselves pushing just that much more to finish their workout. I know this type of influence goes both ways. The stories I hear from those who follow me online inspire me to be the very best I can be every day. I appreciate each and every one of them for their support and sharing with me their journey of bowling success and personal growth. Of course, there are the usual guys that offer other thoughts. Cam is a crazy idiot. Why in the hell would anyone have to run 100 miles in order to bow hunt? Great question. As I've already said, my answer has always been, you don't. I don't have to do this, and nobody else needs to either. I just knew that if I didn't push myself, I wouldn't be where I am today. Conventional wisdom in regard to hunt preparation suggests a typical 20 minutes of exercise a day, 3 times a week, and shooting at 40 yards a couple months before season would suffice. Such a regimen doesn't ruffle feathers, doesn't challenge the norm, doesn't make other men uncomfortable by introducing the concept that maybe they could do more to prepare. At this stage of my life, the quote norm wasn't enough for me or for a lot of other guys who hunt the rugged West. Getting out of your comfort zone and finding out what you are really capable of is almost an awakening of sorts. I know I am an entirely different guy from who I was 25 years ago, and I owe it all to pushing my limits, expecting more of myself, and increasing my pain threshold all in the name of hunting. Now, I would rather quit hunting than go halfway in preparation. It's all I got or nothing. I was ready for the Bighorn 100. This is for one day. Just one day of my life. I can get through anything for a day. My last big preparation weekend, 3 days, as I had Friday off work, couldn't have gone better. In trying to prepare my body for the Bighorn 100, I told myself, the more misery I withstand this weekend, the bigger payoff I will have during the race. I wanted to break myself down all the way mentally and physically, knowing I had 12 days to recover, which to me was a lifetime. I knew my body had a short recovery period. My pile on the miles plan originally was going to cover 2 full days. I figured if I did a tough 20 miles one day, followed up by a 30 miler the next, I would be good to go for the Bighorn, given the previous races I'd run the season. This included back-to-back marathons in the last month. My problem is accepting when enough is enough. After that 24-mile Friday, I logged on to MapMyRun and outlined a sweet 33-mile course with some great hill work thrown in. I figured if I just cruised and made the run last, it'd take me about 6 hours. Perfect. I needed a 6-hour run after the 4-hour 24-mile first leg the day before. The only problem was that left Sunday. What the heck was I supposed to do all day Sunday? Yard work? Grocery shopping? No. I understood the obsessive-compulsive tendencies I'd been known to exhibit when working in endeavors I'm passionate about. I got obsessive about shooting my bow to the point where I wouldn't quit until I felt infallible. Maybe I was overly confident, but mentally, this was where I had been before and a place I loved to be. With running, especially extreme endurance running, I'd never been in this place. Not until this Sunday evening. I had the bright idea of getting some night running in, so I set my alarm for 2:30 a.m. The satanic alarm snapped me out of a deep, deep sleep. After throwing on some clothes and lacing up my UA runners, I was out the door doing a nice 1-hour loop on the dead quiet ghost town-like streets. 7 more miles added to my total. I felt okay afterward. If I can break myself down even further, now's the time to do it. I went back to bed for a few hours, then got up with Trace to have some breakfast and read the paper. Finally, I was able to head out the door. My plan was to head to the Prefontaine Classic over at Hayward Field, where some of the world's most elite athletes were running, and my dad was officiating the jumps. I made it over there, 9 miles into my run, just as the meet was concluding. Watching those world-class guys always inspired me. I had been going to the priest since I was a grade schooler, sometimes just peeking through the fence since I didn't have any money for a ticket. The electricity of the meet made its way to me even way back when, and it did just the same on the Sunday. Running by Hayward, I thought of Priest's quote, "To give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift." Hammering away up the sidewalk from Hayward, I was energized. I passed my grandma's house and was reminded of how much I missed her since she had passed. This is where I'd spent a lot of time listening to the roar of Hayward just a couple blocks away. I powered up the steep grade of the street just beyond where Grandma Lois lived. Making short work of the hill, I pounced down the backside, through Amazon Park, by South Eugene High, to Skinner Butte Park, where Tanner then met me on his trek to ride home with me as I ran. The boys wanted me to take them to Will Ferrell's Land of the Lost, so Tanner wanted to help me get home quicker. It actually helped. With more spring in my step, I finished off the last 5 miles of my 20-mile run with increased effort. "Dad, you seem like you are in a pretty good mood," Tanner told me. I was. I'd done everything I'd set out to do on this last prep weekend before the Bighorn. But this was when my psychoness started to creep in. I have a hard time feeling satisfied, ever. I was sure there was an official diagnosis for this. There was every reason for me to feel content. After logging 85 miles in the last 3 days, which was equivalent to running more than a 26.2-mile marathon 3 days in a row, I expected I would be spent, not able to walk another step, stiff and blistered. Granted, I was tired, but not exhausted. I didn't hurt. I expected to hurt and wanted to hurt. To me, this would signify that there was no question my considerable effort did its job, but I felt no pain, so I was disappointed. Naturally, this made me want to run even more. After a nice carb-loaded dinner with the family, the boys and I headed to the movies. I bought their tickets, their goodies, got them set up in the theater, and leaned down telling them, "I'll be right back. I'm going to go do that 5-mile loop along the river real fast, then come back in, get a Slurpee, and watch the rest of the movie with you. I'll be back in 40 minutes tops." They were fine with it and weren't surprised in the least. They knew me. Outside once again, I took off on a perfect running night and I ran. It was crazy because I felt great. My legs definitely felt like I'd done something, but I could still stride out and run strong. Not super fast, but fluid. I was so pumped. A smile crossed my face, the same sort I'd had on hunts when I was in a zone. This was the feeling I chased every day. I want to keep going, get in another 20-miler. Then I thought of the boys waiting for me, looking into the dark of the theater for my silhouette to appear. As I made my way back to them, I reflected on my weekend. As it was, I pushed my 3-day total to right at 90 miles. Everything was going so well that I became a little afraid that something would go haywire, blown Achilles tendon or something like that. I kept my fingers crossed. I knew I had to fight the urge over the next 12 days not to overtrain heading into Bighorn. When I felt this good, I wanted to push it hard. Bighorn, however, would push back even harder. 100 brutal miles. Over 17,000 feet of total elevation gain. 29 straight hours spent. 20,000 calories burned. All in the name of better bow hunting. Man, did I have so much to learn. As I lined up for the Bighorn Mountain Trail 100 endurance run, I was pumped. But honestly, I was also really nervous. This had been called the fourth toughest ultra marathon in the world. The Bighorn 100 was an out-and-back run consisting of 76 miles of single track, 16 miles of rugged double-track jeep trail, and 8 miles of gravel road with approximately 17,500 feet of climb and 18,000 feet of descent. What that meant was basically you were either running up or running down. Only a fraction of the course was level. I couldn't help thinking about how far 100 miles was. This was my third year in a row competing in a Bighorn race, but my first for this distance. It was a long way to run in any conditions, let alone the high elevation Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming. 100 miles. That's the distance from Eugene to Portland, Oregon. I hated driving to Portland. Now I was going to run that far? Not on a drive I detested, but on a nasty, tough course. At least I knew I'd be running in some beautiful country. The race began at 11 a.m. under sunny skies amid perfect running conditions. For the first hour or so, I thought I was running smart, but I was not. Too fast. Also, I was wearing a borrowed Camelback, which I had never run with. Dumb. It started rubbing immediately and didn't stop for 29 hours. Yep, that rubbed some hide off my lower back and became bleeding silver dollar-sized hotspots. After only 20 miles into the race, I began to wonder if I'd be able to finish. It was 1:30 p.m., and I'd just topped out after a big 4,000-foot climb. Now we were headed down the big drainage on the other side. I hurt already and had 80 miles to go. I decided that I wasn't nearly as tough as I thought I was. In the race packet, the organizers mentioned to be prepared for about anything weather-wise, and they were spot on. We ran in the baking sun, mid-80s, through knee-deep mud, as well as at least a couple miles of post-holing through wet, shoe-soaking snow as the course climbed up over 9,000 feet. By mile 30, around 5 that afternoon, things weren't too bad. Despite lots of pounding on my body coming down and in places where it was too steep to even run, I actually started to feel better. I took in some calories in the form of about a half a peanut butter and bacon sandwich Trace packed for me at home. I was back on pace. Truthfully, I shouldn't have been thinking about time at all. A 100-mile run is not one against the clock for most. It is a race against your body and mind. At 7 p.m., I began feeling like crap again. I started the big 18-mile climb to the turnaround at Porcupine, mile 48. As night fell, I realized I had screwed up thinking I would get to the 9,000-foot-plus aid station sooner, since I didn't have any of my cold-weather UA and no headlamp. I was good until about 10 p.m., then it was too dark to see. I stumbled around in the dark timber, in the snow, falling about every third step. This was not helping my declining attitude. Also, I was freezing as the wind up top was whipping over the ridge. Finally, I got behind someone with a headlamp and rode them into the aid station. The best part of the race came at 11 p.m. at mile 48. I ate some soup, slipped my cold weather stuff on, got my feet bandaged up, and headed back out. The aid station looked like an infirmary. There were some hurting runners in there, but the staff was awesome. I had a nurse put some second skin type stuff on a couple of blisters I developed from running for miles and miles in wet, muddy shoes. That made a big difference. I weighed in, they check your body weight to see if you're dehydrated, and checked out okay. So I was back on course. I lost some weight, but not too much. I bombed out of there, intent on making up some time. It was biting cold up there at the race's 48-mile turnaround, in the 30s for certain. The howling wind, approaching midnight and daunting beyond, combined to make the Porcupine aid station a real convenient spot for DNFers. That was the official notation on the race results for runners who quit. DNF. Did not finish. I saw guys at Porcupine. Tough guys, obviously. I mean, hell. To get there, they just ran 48 miles. The last 18, all uphill, to the tune of a 4,500-foot gain, looking like they were on their deathbeds, wrapped in blankets, being attended to by medics. It was at Porcupine that many called it a race. But that wasn't the only place guys quit. At almost every aid station, even the most remote, there are runners sitting there having turned in their race bib. To get hauled out from the remote stations, it was going to have to be on horseback, but it didn't matter. They simply weren't going to or couldn't run another step. Before this race, I could never see myself quitting. Now I had a new appreciation for just how far down you could go. Not only physically, but most importantly, mentally. I believe most of the guys quit because mentally it was too much. Granted, there were some who battled hypothermia and straight up exhaustion, but more than anything, they lost a battle between their ears. On this note, I ran for a time with one old boy who was doing his 35th 100-mile ultra. I thought to myself as we ran through the mountains, someone that tough, there's no way he's ever quit a race. So I asked him, and yep, he'd had to bail on 3 100s over the years. This had to be one of the most intense events ever. By 2 a.m., 15 hours of running was a new experience for me, and so far, not real enjoyable. It was at this time I became envious of those who had a pacer or a crew there supporting them. Some runners had a friend or family member run critical segments of the race with them. I was crewless, and right about now it sucked. I had a nice Eminem mix that Tanner had put together for me on my iPod, and while his Me Against the World shtick motivates me most of the time, right now, I was just feeling sorry for myself. There were times when I had a hard time even walking. Everything hurt. I had no energy. I planned on knocking out this 18 miles back to the bottom quickly, but now it seemed like I was losing time. Yes, I was losing the battle, but the war was not yet over. Cam, why do you have to go overboard on everything? Can't you just do a regular marathon or something not so extreme? Stuff like that is too hard on your body. I don't think it's a good idea. I could hear Trace's words, and now I was asking myself those same questions. It reminded me of one of the early wilderness trips I took by myself. Before leaving, a doctor had found a blood infection in my leg and told me I couldn't go, but I still went. On that hunt, I found myself alone in the cold and the snow, sitting in the wilderness and questioning why I was there. I felt pretty selfish for being away from my family. Is this necessary? It was one thing to read some stranger on social media asking me this, but now it was my own voice I heard. Yeah, it is necessary, I answered back silently. I need to be out of my comfort zone. You never forget experiences like this. They help you to grow. The Bighorn race packet contained a warning, one I ignored. To ensure a sufficiently experienced and trained field of participants, each runner should be aware of the extremely rugged terrain and difficulty this course presents. This will increase the likelihood that the participants will be prepared to deal with a rugged course and unpredictable mountain weather to safely participate in the event. It is important for the participant to recognize the potential physical and mental stresses which may evolve from participation in this race. The runners may be subject to extreme temperatures of heat and cold, hypothermia, heat stroke, kidney failure, seizures, low blood sugar, disorientation, injury, falling rock or trees, wild animal or reptile attack, or even death from their participation in this event. I thought this was a little good old-fashioned hyperbole before I ran. It is not. This race would teach me something. I could fake my way through 50Ks and even 50 milers, but I could not fake it through 100 miles. 100-mile runs are tough. Much tougher than I gave them credit for. Not only did this test my physical abilities, but it also pushed my mental capabilities. I could run and did fairly well if I didn't have to use any intelligence. I could run a regular 26.2-mile marathon like Boston, New York, or Eugene, never thinking, barely drinking, just hammering it out. If I had to be smart, game over. A 100 required being smart. But I wasn't finished with the game. Not yet. I'd entered the race thinking that I should be able to get in around 24 hours, given this and that, referring to my baseless logic. Well, last year, my third place overall finish in the Bighorn 50 mile brought me in just under 9 hours. Cool, double nine, add a little for fatigue, and bingo, 24. You failed the class, Cam. I ran the SOB 31 mile 50K with 7,000 feet of gain, in right at 4 hours. I can bust 100 miles out in 24 hours just by staying steady. Nope. Mine was a flawed math. There was a huge difference between running for 4 hours or even 9 hours and 24 or more. Besides, 9 hours was the longest I had ever run in my life, and I did it only one time. Even after I told myself a million times that there was one mistake I desperately needed to avoid, I took off way too fast. I also didn't eat or drink the way I should have, and after about 40 miles, I blew up. I recovered a bit at the turnaround, then told myself I was going to make up some time heading back down the hill to footbridge at mile 66. Not so fast. For a couple hours, I had a hard time even walking. I was sick. I was dehydrated, or maybe overhydrated after drinking a ton at the turnaround. My hands were swollen. I was by myself. And the lowest of lows was at about 3 a.m. when I was trying to make it down to the bottom of the canyon. I was hurting as bad as I had ever hurt up to that time in my life. After that, I hurt worse. At 6 a.m., I finally made it to mile 66. I weighed in, was still down, but still okay. I ate a pancake and sausage, knowing there were 34 more miles to go and another brutal 17-mile climb up Dry Fork. There were parts of this that were nasty steep, but I never stopped. There was no way you could run it. Power hiking was the only option. I hammered away and actually caught up and passed some runners near the Dry Fork aid station. I can safely say that 6-hour climb was one of the longest of my life. It was unrelenting. At 12 p.m., I topped out at mile 82. I felt pretty pumped. Every ounce of me hurt, but I tried to keep a smile on my face. Sean M. from Sisters, Oregon gave me this tip. No matter how bad things are going, smiling always helps. I thought I'd try it on my next tough hunt. I was at 25 hours now. My 24-hour goal was long gone, but I didn't care in the least. I had readjusted, and now I was going to finish in the 20s. Even if it was 29 hours, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds, I would get it done. I had 5 hours to get the last 18 miles. Seemed doable enough, so long as my body held up. That was a problem. Now I was really dried out. I weighed in at 153, 10 pounds down from my official weigh-in of 163 the day before. I needed to take in some fluids, which was a common theme for me during this race. I ate some watermelon, a PB&J, chatted with a few bow hunters, said hi to Dennis from Oregon who had been progressing right along with me for the past 12 hours or so, then hit the road. Here's what I learned. 18 miles, while compared to 82, was not much, but it was still a long way. Thankfully, I proved something else to myself. I'm tougher than I thought I was. The New York Times wrote this about the race. And a few humbling realizations that the Bighorn Mountains could not be conquered by a mere human on foot. That shoe-sucking mud and thigh-deep snowbanks and steep climbs that sometimes felt as if they would never end were things that at best could be fought only to a draw, and even then only with luck. And that as tough as you think you are, there is always somebody tougher and faster, and that the course itself, in the end, would always be tougher still. No matter how tough I might think I am, I know the mountains will always be tougher. The mountain will always have the upper hand. By 3:10 p.m., I reached the last aid station at mile 95. I came bombing off the hill and down 4,000 feet as best I could, but that 13 miles hurt. My right Achilles was really acting up. After the race, I realized something was seriously wrong with it after that ankle swelled to twice the size of my left and I couldn't walk. Speaking of my left ankle, it felt like it had a bone sticking out of the top of my foot, which I just ignored, pushed on, and it felt better. Perhaps I could be a doctor. My right knee had a catch, so if I stopped running, I could hardly get started again. I kept thinking of a favorite quote from Mexican revolutionary Emiliano Zapata. It is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. I knew I had to push through the pain. When I got to mile 95, Tanner was there waiting for me and ran the last 5 with his old man. That a boy. I told him I couldn't stop because of my knee and said we had 1 hour and 50 minutes to run 5 miles. That just sounded weird. Normally at home, I could click off 5 miles in less than 30 minutes. Different time, different place. Off we went, running slowly, walking fast, just moving forward. Always. That was one thing I did the entire race, and I have to thank Under Armour's Ann Bonney. In an email before the race, she advised RFP, Relentless Forward Progress. I never stopped one time on the course, only to change shoes at the aid stations. Tanner and I joked around. After about 2 miles of our run together, he said he was tired. He also said he was surprised how good a mood I was in. Looks can be deceiving. At 4:20 p.m., 100 miles were in the books. Official time, 29 hours, 20 minutes. I was a 100-mile ultramarathoner. I earned my first 100-miler belt buckle. It wasn't long ago that the thought of me running 100 miles in the mountains wasn't possible. I was pumped for the future, for new challenges, new tests, new dreams. No matter what happened in my life, the highs and lows, no one could ever take this from me. I felt like I did when I arrowed my first 6x6 bull. Of course, my inner demon attempted to steal a bit of my thunder. 27th place wasn't where I dreamt to finish. but I knew all too well that adversity and shattered dreams were great teachers. You can either get to work and get better or wallow. A good testament to just how difficult this race could be, even to seasoned ultramarathoners, was that only about 60% of the confirmed entrants finished a race, and just 34 runners came in under 30 hours. I remembered finishing 29th in my first ever ultra, a 50K, back in 2005. From there, I slowly chipped away and got better at the shorter ultras. Reaching new heights, achieving more, and gaining confidence allowed me to get to this point here, which again, years from now, I'd look back and say, I remember my first 100. I learned a lot from that race. Bow hunting was the same way. Years ago, I wanted to kill big bulls and bucks and travel to Alaska and other exotic places and countries. The problem was, I couldn't go from a rookie bow hunter to the success I longed for in one giant leap. Earn your breaks. Hone your skills. Develop a talent. Eventually, your dreams will become a reality. The lessons I learned in the mountains of Wyoming that weekend were fresh and painful. They were also necessary. I'm thankful for every second I've spent in the Bighorn Mountains. Feel like giving up on your dreams? I've been at a point where I didn't know if I could run another step, feeling sorry for myself, knowing I could have gone back to bed and no one would have known any different. But I would have known, so I got up and did it anyway. The lesson I learned was even when you feel like you're done, you're not done. Endurance means you are never done. The passion you hold inside will always be there, whether it's boiling through your veins or buried deep in your heart. To endure means to never end, to know the journey is long, to bear with the long days and weeks and sometimes even years. The miles mean something. Each step means something. Life is all about endurance and forging on, even when you're beaten down. Find comfort in being uncomfortable. It is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. Emiliano Zapata. Words can be fuel, and phrases can become fire. Some inspire me to go out on my feet fighting, working, digging deep for all I am worth, not on my knees, bowing down to physical weakness, life setbacks, discomfort, or fear. Sometimes I need to repeat quotes like that as if they were mantras. It's better to die, I tell myself as I hammer away, stride after stride, sometimes before the crack of dawn, sometimes on tough, steep, and muddy trails, sometimes when I want to quit in the worst way. Excuses are easy to come by. Pushing through is not. With ultramarathons, I know I will be miserable, no doubt, but I've found that I can handle misery. My good friend Misery and I have become real close over the years. I've also found that your body will respond and adapt to almost any challenge you put before it. I have learned this in the mountains on long hunts, on the race course, and in training in the blistering heat or in the driving rain. Our bodies are capable of amazing things if we take off the shackles of doubt, toughen up, sacrifice, and dig deep. Our spirits are capable of the same. Dare to be defiant. Dare others to doubt your abilities. Damn the conventional wisdom from skeptics and experts and morons. It's better to die on your feet. People might think ultramarathons are too psycho, unrealistic, self-serving, or unnecessary, and that is cool. I've heard it all. What works for some does not work for others. My only suggestion is to find something that helps you to be the very best you can be. Find inspiration somewhere. Find what works for you. Then give it all you have. I'd rather be dead than average. I saw this quote on Mark Bell's Instagram page and agree. I simply can't give a half-assed, average effort to anything I'm passionate about. I gotta go hard and give all I got. I'm not talented. I'm just a bow hunter like many others. The only thing that sets me apart is my drive to do more and expect more from myself, all while ignoring the doubters and the naysayers that are always there trying to sabotage us dream chasers. My average God-given talent coupled with an average effort would yield average results and therefore unfulfilled dreams. With that, I'd rather be dead, because what's worse than unfulfilled potential? The good news is I believe each one of us is capable of greatness in something. Have you found that something? The only reason people know my name is because I found bow hunting many years ago and was consumed with being the best I could be. It's changed my life for the better and helped me provide a better life for my family. Bow hunting led to writing, magazine editing, TV hosting, sponsorships, endurance racing, and having a connection with all you through social media, of which I am so grateful because your passion has, in turn, pushed me to greater heights. Your quote, bow hunting is out there, I promise. It will open doors for you as well. But be warned, when you become obsessed, it takes over your life. This obsessive approach works for me. It has changed my life, impacted others positively, and most importantly, has taught my kids that anything is possible. Dreams come true every single day. Yours can come true too, but it's going to take some damn hard work. If you're like me, that's fine. Just keep telling yourself the mantra, it is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. Go out fighting. Chapter 10, Last Load. Have you ever just stopped and asked yourself in what ways the world is better because you are in it? How are you impacting the people and places around you? What is your influence? What will they say at your funeral? How will you be remembered? Strength and courage, they inspire people. Physical strength and bravery in the heat of battle. But even the physically weakest individuals can exhibit these traits. In the final year of my dad's life, he reminded me once again how much I respected and admired him. From the moments doctors discovered a lump on his liver, Bob Haynes began his fight with cancer. It was an aggressive form of cancer, but he never gave up. For 18 months, he waged a war against it. "I'm going to beat it," he told me. Everybody who gets cancer says this, and sometimes they do. Other times, it seems like they'll beat it because doctors begin pumping them with chemo and it hammers the cancer down. It seems like they're winning, but they're not, because they can't take that chemo forever. It's poison. Oftentimes, after the chemo stops, cancer comes back, and when it does, it's even worse than before. After being diagnosed at the start of 2009, my dad had been saying he was going to beat liver cancer, and in the spring of 2010, doctors couldn't believe how good he was doing. Throughout this time, he still tried to coach and do everything he always did. The chemo temporarily worked, but the side effects were rough. He was so exhausted, yet he could never rest. There was a constant ringing in his ears. He clung on, but with something like liver cancer, this was an impossible battle to win. Dad never beat it, but he continued to inspire me and others who knew him, even in those last moments and weeks and days of his life. While I look up to many, my dad was the only true hero I've ever had. He showed me why during those last tough months. We love to see when people persevere. My dad continued to hang on to hope during his battle. One of the hardest things I've experienced in my life was seeing my dad slowly die. Cancer is a devastating disease, and while there's nothing positive about losing your dad to cancer, the one thing I was thankful for was a chance to have many quality, loving, heartfelt, and sometimes emotional talks with my dad. While he battled, we bonded. Those talks with him are moments in my life I will always hold dear. Another thing that stood out to me was the way my dad fought. There were times when he was scared and depressed that he was going to be leaving us, because truthfully, he didn't want to. Regardless of his fears, he never quit. He kept fighting. Why do you do what you do? Why do you run or compete? For Truett, my youngest son, he ran his first marathon for Grandpa Bob, and he crushed it. Even though Truett was only 13, instead of the marathon minimum age 16, which meant I had to lie just to get him in, he ran the 26.2-mile Eugene Marathon in 3 hours, 30 minutes, and 41 seconds. I was really proud of him. I finished in 3 hours and 1 minute, and Trace did the half in 1 hour and 49 minutes. Tanner also got in on the action, pacing his little brother for about 8 miles of the race. An even prouder parenting moment came when Truett gave his marathon finisher's medal to my dad. He was very pleased with Truett for getting that marathon done. I've come to love the struggle, And every struggle, physical, emotional, spiritual, pushes us past our breaking points. The most coveted award in the ultramarathoning world is a silver buckle awarded at the Western States Endurance Run. It's the most famous 100-mile race in the world because of its history and competitiveness. I earned my buckle in my second 100-miler by finishing in under 24 hours at 22 hours and 41 minutes. In my world, if there was ever a comparison to an Olympic gold medal, it would be the silver buckle. I felt like it was my greatest personal athletic achievement, but it came at a bittersweet time of my life. All through the race, I thought of my dad, who was fighting hard for each extra day he could on this earth. His obituary would read, "Robert Bob Haynes, born on January 2, 1948 in Seattle, to Lester and Halois Williamson Haynes. After graduating from South Eugene High School, he attended the University of Oregon. At one time, he worked as a baker, then had a job in sporting goods sales. He owned and operated a record store in Portland. His true passion, however, was coaching track and field pole vaulters and jumpers. I remember as a little boy looking through his athletic scrapbook hundreds of times. The newspaper clippings, medals, plaques, he was my hero. Unlike me, he had awesome athletic ability. Coming out of South Eugene High, he was a D1 athlete, meaning a collegiate athlete at the highest level, in both track and field and gymnastics. My dad seemed to have it all. He was smart, talented, and everyone in Eugene knew him. To me, his oldest son, Bob Haynes, was larger than life. While putting in miles training for the Western States race, I would think of how my dad refused to give up battling inoperable liver cancer. I admired his strength and courage. Whenever I didn't want to run, lift, or shoot my bow, I pictured his frail and failing body and thought, who am I to be lazy? On the drive down to where the race started in Olympic Valley, California, I talked to my dad on the phone and he didn't sound good. He'd been battling cancer for a year and a half, so I knew in my heart he was nearing the end of his fight. As I ran, I took some solace in knowing he was following my progress live on the WS100.com website. What running Western States proved to me was that I could achieve all my mountain bow hunting dreams. I convinced myself that if I could run 100 miles through the Sierra Nevada mountains with 41,000 feet of total elevation change in over 90 degree heat, while battling mental and physical fatigue and despair in less than one day, I could do just about anything. I'd put in the work, now it was time to reap the rewards. At 3:41 a.m., I crossed the finish line in Auburn, California, and in doing so, earned my silver Western States buckle. I just logged a nearly 7-hour improvement over my first 100-mile race. I started out the race supremely confident, but during those 22 hours and 41 minutes of reflection while running, doubt crept in more than once. Through those struggles, I kept telling myself that my pain was temporary. In a few days' time, I'd be healed up and richer from the experience. For my dad, there would be no healing. There would be only deeper and more debilitating pain and sickness than death. I finished a race Sunday morning and we drove home that day, getting home very late. I went to work the next day, then headed over to my dad's house, eager to tell him in person that I loved him and give him a hug on the heels of my successful race. As a lifelong track guy, he appreciated a solid athletic performance as much as anyone. Dad and I started out my life's journey together, then through circumstances and challenge had drifted apart, but things were back in order. My brother, Pete, spent a lot of time with Dad during the past few months, which warmed my heart. From back when I was 5 years old, when my mom and dad divorced, I'd always just want us all back together. I will never forget looking into Dad's eyes upon my return from the race and saying, "Dad, I wish I could give you some of my strength." "Don't give up on me," he told me, "not yet." He still thought he was going to beat it. I will never forget his will to live. A handful of days after I had earned my silver buckle in the Western States race, my dad passed on early in the day on July 5th. The pain of losing him was much worse than any I'd felt before from races, life, or anything. My dad's greatest reward came in helping others achieve their full potential. He also loved sharing a beautiful, masterful piece of music with them. He believed it could enrich their lives. Music was as much or more a part of his life than anything. He had a passion and a love for track and field, but music for my dad was a spiritual journey at times. Music spoke to my dad, especially the work of Brian Wilson, creator, songwriter, and producer of his favorite group, the Beach Boys. As a young man, he started listening to the Beach Boys like just about everyone else did for the fun, summer-themed tracks they put out. Then he began to appreciate the other side of Brian Wilson's spectrum of music. He became an unofficial Beach Boys historian and was friends with Brian Wilson. My dad most enjoyed the songs with deeper meanings, like In My Room, God Only Knows, and many of the tracks off Smile, which my dad himself helped compile. My dad, along with many others in the music industry, saw Brian Wilson as a genius. Maybe a touch eccentric. Most geniuses are, they say. But still, an amazingly gifted man. Brian's music was powerful medicine to my dad. I will never forget seeing my dad standing there at his reel-to-reel deck, the Beach Boys rolling, cranked to deafening levels. He would sing with all his heart, eyes closed, head back, more a part of the music than one could ever be. Then he would turn to whomever was there with him, with a look that said, "Are you getting this too? Are you feeling this?" That was my dad as much as anything else. A couple of nights before my dad's funeral, I bought a new Beach Boys Greatest Hits CD. I had listened to the Beach Boys songs hundreds and thousands of times over the years, but listening to those familiar songs in my truck brought my dad back to me in some little way. There's nothing quite like music in that regard. At my dad's funeral, I spoke to the crowd gathered in the South Eugene High School Gymnasium to celebrate Bob Haynes' life. I know for certain my dad, Bob Haynes, would be overjoyed with this get-together today, I said. Friends, family, music, and memories. I hope he's looking down on us now, smiling, feeling the love that fills this gym. The people I spoke to were all giving up part of their day to honor my dad. Their presence meant so much to me and the rest of my family. To me, it means my dad has either impacted you or maybe just someone close to you. For instance, I know for a fact there are some here who only met my dad once in his life, but because they care for me and my family and know what my dad meant to us, they are here showing their love and support. My dad is gone, but he's bringing people together. He's still making an impact. I shared several memories and reflections of my dad that I would never forget, especially the memories of the small, impressionable boy I once was. I vividly remember my mom telling me that my dad's legs were so strong and muscular, they were as hard as tree trunks. Then I'd poke at them, and of course, she was right. I also remember late one night when he got home from a softball game, just he and I were up. We were eating cereal. Me in a little wood rocking chair, and him leaning over his bowl, seated on the edge of the couch. He watched TV. I watched him. His knee was bleeding pretty good from sliding into a base. I remember sitting there, staring at the bloody wound, mesmerized by his seeming invincibility. I reminded everybody sitting in the gym that just like them, my dad wasn't perfect. I will never forget how he would take his experiences and use them to help others. He had been there and done that, so to speak. He competed on the field and in life, won some battles and lost others. He wasn't afraid to own up to the mistakes he made when I was growing up. He was upfront and honest with everyone, which helped build trust in many of the young adults he mentored. He talked and shared. They listened and learned. I would guess many times they walked away thinking of what he'd told them. I know I did. Maybe they still think of the advice he'd given. As a rule, kids like to blow adults off. The key is to get them to listen. And he could, because he spoke from the heart, and he had no agenda other than to simply help them navigate successfully through life. Plus, the way he spoke, with unwavering confidence, looking you in the eye, you'd believe anything he told you. As I shared my dad's passion for music and the Beach Boys, we had a special surprise for everybody. I had received a special musical tribute from Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, which I played at the service. He sang God Only Knows acoustic and ended it with "We Love You, Bob." My dad would have been so happy to hear that personal tribute to him from the iconic Brian Wilson. We were so thankful he took the time out to acknowledge Bob Haynes. I shared a story with the crowd about a guy I had worked for a couple years prior who treated people like crap and he knew it. In fact, one night over a few beers, he wondered if anyone would come to his funeral. He asked me, "Will you come?" Of course, I answered that yes, I'd be there. What was I supposed to say? I was an employee. He still had doubts. I would never forget him writing a contract on a napkin saying that I agreed to come to his funeral. Partly it was in jest, but there was some truth to it. He was genuinely concerned, and rightfully so. My dad didn't need to be concerned about attendance at his funeral. Here were hundreds of people gathered together for no other reason than the love we felt for Bob Haynes. Whether they knew him as dad, as Pete, Justin, and I did, or as a husband, as my stepmom Candy did, or as a coach, like all his athletes did, or as Beach Boy Bob, or just as a friend, everyone there would acknowledge that my dad, if given a chance, could enrich their lives. If helping others realizing their dreams and enriching lives isn't the true definition of success, I don't know what is. My dad's life proves to me that strength of character is a lot more important than worldly riches. A week after the memorial service, I hunted the Nevada wilderness for 8 brutally tough days. It was one of the least productive hunts I'd ever been on. I saw 20 deer total. Luckily, I had a good partner and cameraman, Jody Sear, who was tough as nails. Leaving for the hunt was not easy for me so soon after losing my dad. Ideally, when leaving for a tough hunt, a guy wants everything in order to be focused on the challenging task at hand, having a heightened sense of things. Such was not the case. But regardless, bow hunting is what I do. It's who I am. So I loaded up my pack and gave it everything I had. 2 months later, I found myself flying home from British Columbia on my birthday, October 2nd. I had a few voicemails and texts wishing me a good B-Day, but all I could think about was that for the first time ever in my life, my dad wouldn't be calling or giving me a hug, telling me he loved me and to have a happy birthday. I knew that people lose loved ones and that at some point, everyone is going to lose their dad. I was not unique in that regard. But my dad dying was the worst heartache I'd ever felt. Honoring him was what gave me strength when I was at my weakest, and I needed that strength throughout the 2010 hunting season. No elk in Wyoming, no breaks for a while in Colorado, through the pouring rain and tough hunting in Oregon, and finally BC, week after week on the road, grinding away in the unrelenting mountains. All throughout these weeks, my dad's courage to fight as long as he could inspired me every day. As a kid, I missed having a dad to share things with growing up, and it hurt, but I was able to use the pain for motivation. Now that he was gone forever, I vowed to succeed, whether it be in bow hunting or ultra running, in his honor. The Beach Boys played in my earbuds as I ran. If you should ever leave me, though life would still go on, believe me. Ever since my dad died in 2010, every time I run a race in Eugene, I spend most of the time thinking about him. There are so many things that remind me of him. Hayward Field, of course, where he competed as an athlete and officiated for years. Amazon Parkway, a major street in Eugene, which is close to where he last lived. The house he lived in before that on Ferry Street. South Eugene High School, where he graduated and coached for decades. My grandma's old house, where he grew up on 24th and Emerald, where I spent many days growing up myself. I'll never forget my dad's eagerness for life, his thirst for knowledge as reflected in his extensive and widely varied library. He was easily the smartest, most well-read person I've ever met. We had many interesting conversations, me being a bow-hunting redneck, him being a South Eugene liberal. I loved the bantering. He thought the NBA playoffs were fixed every year. I always just laughed, saying, "Come on, Dad," but secretly gave some credence to his theory. There are so many memories of those that I love and miss every day, but those same memories helped push me yesterday, power me through today, and will be there for me tomorrow. I miss and love you, Dad. God only knows what I'd be without you. Do you have a passion that's neglected or unfulfilled? Have you given up on the dreams you once held when you were younger? My dad never competed in the Olympics, yet he took his passion and gifts to the world of track and field, and he helped others achieve their full potential. Unachieved goals don't have to result in unused gifts. Part 3, The Ultimate Predator. All my dreams and goals have always centered around success in the woods, being able to tell a story and sharing a journey. Chapter 11, The Best Never Rest. No man has a right to be an amateur in the matter of physical training. It is a shame for a man to grow old without seeing the beauty and strength of which his body is capable. Socrates. I just saw this Rumi quote that I love. Set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. The Philly translation of that is don't be hanging around with no jank-ass jokers that don't help you shine. The prerequisite for spending time with any person is that they nourish and inspire you. They feed your flame. Look at your last 5 text messages. Are those people feeding your flames or dousing your fire? Put your phone down for just a second and look around. Look to the people around you. Are those people throwing logs on your fire or are they pissing on it? The people that you spend time with are going to make or break your dreams. Everybody don't deserve to be around you. You've got to defend your life with your life. So who are the people in your life that are fanning the flames?